You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In her new memoir, The Receptionist, English professor Janet Groth chronicles the 21 years she spent as a receptionist at The New Yorker, working for literary luminaries like E.B. White and Joseph Mitchell and the magazine's legendary editor, William Shawn. Ms. Groth recounts the personalities and relationships that influenced her life in this book that was published by Algonquin. I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You write that Muriel Spark, the novelist and New Yorker contributor, often said that both the artist and the criminal like to take us by surprise.
Yes, what? She was very mischievous that way. She liked the link with crime and used it very often.
Well, I was thinking, what would surprise people most about what it was like to work at The New Yorker from 1957 to 1978, the years that you worked there?
I think they may have had an idea that we were sophisticated and moving around in more of a Mad Men ambiance, when in fact, if they had taken seriously Brendan Gill's description, which was spot on about the drabness that was part of the mystique, the linoleum floors, the gray walls, the filing cabinets, that was what we were moving around in. And thanks to Ms. Terry, who wanted the young women who worked in the editorial staff to wear nylons and peck-and-peck dresses and low heels, well, it was a little bit different, less swishy and glitzy than Mad Men, for sure.
But on the other hand, you did have James Thurber doing drawings on the wall of his office.
Yes, to say nothing of St. Clair McKelway when he was off his meds.
So after you left, were there certain things that you missed?
Oh, well, I think maybe having stayed as long as I did, there was less regret about missing anything and perhaps a rueful look back, did I stay too long at the party?
You repeatedly portray yourself as the ingenue, both in your professional and personal relationships. And when E.B. White interviewed you for the job in 1957, you were only 19. Where did you get the gumption to leave the Midwest and even come to New York City and take a job like this?
I think it had something to do with Lauren Bacall and the film noir of the 1940s. My mother and father owned a movie theater in that period, and I was the popcorn girl. I saw movies 7 days a week, and many of them started with New York, an aerial picture of Lower Manhattan, and that's where I was going to come.
There was usually a shot from across the river,
the
skyline, and then we saw people going into the subway and into office buildings. And
the next thing you knew, Jean Tierney was Laura.
Did you think that you'd start as a receptionist and then move up the ranks at The New Yorker?
Because
you write, moving either into the checking department or to a job as talk of the town reporter, and perhaps from one of those positions to the most coveted of spots as a regular contributor with a drawing account.
A great many of the young men that I was having drinks with in those days were doing just that.
So why didn't that happen with you?
I leave you to deduce that we were in a pre-feminist era. Nobody really thought it was unusual that I should be staying where I was staying, getting the coffee I was getting.
But if you'd been a bit more aggressive?
Ah, if Oprah had been around, if there'd been some assertiveness training, absolutely.
You write that during a trip to Greece, you realized your, quote, only identifiable relationship to the world was a sexual one. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was having a really major identity crisis. It was very difficult for me to put my small-town Iowa life together, particularly because my father had been a drinker and had, even though he was a merchant in that 900 population town that we lived in, he was not, he was known to hang out in the local beer joints. So somehow the looks that the children of people like that got were just calculated to give us low self-esteem. That's all I can tell you.
And do you think that self-perception is part of the reasons you never were promoted? I mean, you did request promotions, but they seem to be rather discreetly.
Yes, very.
If you'd campaigned for a job, do you think that would have
been different? It would have been different. My goodness. Pauline Kael, for example, knew exactly how to manipulate Mr. Shawn. All you had to do was say some bad words and, you know, be feisty as all get out. All the things I wasn't.
Although Mr. Shaw never allowed bad words into the magazine, it had to wait.
Until very late in the game, yeah. That's true.
But you did receive a lot of perks, and you got to meet a lot of your cultural heroes.
Yes.
Is that what kept you going?
Yes, certainly. That and a sense that I was still a writer in my own head and in my blue notebooks that were stashed away in my drawers and that finally got used in this book.
Well, later you wound up writing books and you
yes.
became a professor. Did you go to school while you were working at the New York?
I did. For many long years, there was a question of going down to NYU for an evening class, and I didn't seem to put together the grants possibilities or the student loan possibilities. So my advisor, my graduate advisor, said to me, at this rate, one course a semester, I'm not going to live to see you get the doctorate. And he didn't, for Professor Hopper. But
you did get the
yes,
doctorate.
Yes, I did.
When E.B. White interviewed you for the receptionist job, you told him you chose not to become a skilled typist because you didn't want to end up in the office typing pool. Did you ever learn how to type?
Well, the New Yorker paid for what was that woman who ran the secretarial, Kate somebody. Anyway, they did pay for a typing lesson for me, and it didn't take, that is, it didn't take sufficiently for me to go to the typing pool.
Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, they probably stuck something in front of you and said, could you please type this?
Well, Muriel Spark. Particularly, yes.
Who doesn't come across as the most lovable person in the world in this book?
Well, it's possible that one can say that Mr. Shawn had his own mishigas, you know, and it had basically a benign intent, but the result was not always benign.
You write that one of the things you appreciated most about the receptionist job was the way it allowed you to try on alternative lives. What sort of lives did you try on?
Oh, yes. Well, thanks to Anthony and Anthony, as he says, and Margot Bailey, I sat their house. It was a wonderful, I believe, Georgian. I'm very weak on British architecture, but it was a wonderful house in Royal Hill in Greenwich, England. And they had a Springer Spaniel that needed walking in Queen's Park every day. And they sailed off the New England coast every summer and needed someone in Greenwich to watch the house and walk Daisy and feed Rocket, the tortoise who lived in the garden. So I lived a very special life those weeks that I was looking after all of the Bailey residents.
And then you got tickets to the ballet and
yes, there were many perks in New York as well.
Well, the New Yorker writer Jack Kahn wrote in his memoir about the New Yorker and me that you were one of the magazine's authentic oddities. How did you react to that?
Well, I reacted with great surprise and shock because, of course, it was clear to me that the oddities were other people that had often been written about as hypochondriacs and people with great eccentricity. And just because I was, well, I said I thought of myself as a little bit out of step because I was a Lutheran and a churchgoer. Excuse me, a churchgoer in a club full of secular humanists. Nevertheless, I did not think of myself as an authentic oddity until Jack so described me, but I think I probably was.
My guest is Janet Groth, who's written a memoir called The Receptionist and Education at the New Yorker. It is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. You mentioned Mad Men, and this book is often compared to that series. I'm assuming you've seen it.
I have.
Is the show true to your experience working as a receptionist
well,
in the 50s
you know,
and 60s?
We heard about those people over on Madison Avenue. We only dreamed about them. And, of course, Don Draper would have completely had me in his thrall. And does now, but you have to imagine a lot less glitz at the New Yorker.
Then you did earn that master's degree and then a PhD and left in 1978 to take a teaching job at the University of Cincinnati.
Yes.
Was that preferable to just leaving and doing something big at another magazine?
It had everything to do with the work I had been doing with my analyst, who at the time that I asked him very tentatively, do you think I could earn a PhD? He said, isn't it just about time you did something that was good for you? And he also called me a poor sport if I didn't overcome my fears about writing a dissertation, and it was the source of my self-esteem and my maturation finally.
Well, you're an Edmund Wilson scholar. You've written four books about him.
Yes.
And he frequently contributed to The New Yorker. Did you ever meet him?
Oh, he was on the floor when Patriotic Gore was being put through the press, and I was much too intimidated to actually approach him.
So why him?
The woman who succeeded me as in Joseph Mitchell's life, Sheila McGraw, the office manager, and I used to have drinks after work of a Friday. And when I was casting about for a dissertation subject, she said, "Why don't you write on Edmund Wilson?" And thereby
hangs the tale. Is that simple?
Yes.
And then you wound up becoming an expert on him.
Yes.
One of the best chapters in the book pays homage to the poet John Berryman, who was first your college professor and later a colleague at The New Yorker. Did his teaching inspire you to become a professor?
I think so. I think if I had an aspiration to a model in the classroom, it would have certainly been John Berryman. People mistake my having used that chapter in my New Yorker memoirs, his having been around much more than he was. He came in periodically to talk with Louise Bogan, the poetry editor, but not often.
In your last years, you were still just earning $168 a week.
Yes, can you believe it? True. I found my paycheck stub to prove it.
How did you survive?
I was paying $80 a month rent down on 12th Street with a landlord who later became my husband, meant much later, but that's another story.
At least it saved you $80 a month.
Yes. No. I paid my rent faithfully. The thing is that rent-controlled apartment was key to the survival on that kind of paycheck.
In the closing scene at a farewell gathering, you say was too informal to be called a party. The magazine's editor-in-chief, William Shawn, makes a token appearance and presents you with a single red rose. One reviewer wrote that he wished that you would toss it back into his face.
Or somewhere else. Yes, I know it was a rude suggestion. I think that would have been overkill. After all, there were all those perks. I do list the perks, and I say it was really not clear to me who was exploiting whom.
It's good that you worked it out that way. Others have taken it a little differently. Some people are outraged for you as they read the book. Uh-huh. You taught for years at the University of Cincinnati, but you're back in Manhattan these days. Have you left academia?
I don't know. I just finished a course in the summer session up at Columbia, wonderful course in Melville and Hawthorne. Enjoyed that very much. So perhaps my hat isn't completely back on the rack. I should say that my longest tenured position was at the State University at Plattsburgh in New York.
And now you've written this memoir after the books on Edmund Wilson. You have any future plans?
Well, I do. I may have touched on it when I suggested that there was a story in that landlord.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Janet Groth, her memoir, The Receptionist, An Education at The New Yorker, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.